Today at Radio Verulam, we're once again speaking to local MP Daisy Cooper. As it is December and coming to the close of 2020, this show has a slightly different approach as we look back at the last 12 months, appraising them. However, next month in January, we will be back to the usual format. But before we get into the appraisal of all your work in the last 12 months, Daisy, could you give us a little insight how Parliament will work over this festive period and how governance will still continue?
So over the Christmas break, Parliament goes into recess, and what that means is that MPs don't go into Parliament and they don't take part in the regular proceedings. But if there is some kind of emergency, or if there is a big political development, for example, we're waiting to hear about the outcome of the Brexit negotiations, then there are different things that can happen. So Parliament can be recalled, and what that means is that MPs will sort of physically and virtually return to Parliament to start that debate again, and it's entirely possible that MPs will be recalled to Parliament as early as next week perhaps, or perhaps between Christmas and New Year, if there is an outcome from the EU-UK negotiations for us to debate and possibly vote on. But if there are other events that happen outside of events that don't require us to actually have a debate, then often there are daily phone calls with government ministers that we can join if we have specific questions. So whilst Parliament isn't physically sitting, and whilst you won't see anything on the BBC Parliament TV page, MPs are still working hard, still running surgery, still talking to constituents, and we'll be working sort of throughout the break, obviously taking Christmas Day off itself, but otherwise we're still here and available to help people, and we'll still be picking up issues in Parliament if we need to.
A fascinating insight into how Parliament still continues behind closed doors. You know, people don't really often see that through this Christmas period. But I have to take you back now, Daisy, to 52 weeks ago, where you ran a successful campaign and became the first Liberal Democrat MP of St Albans since 1904. What were your feelings at the time, and why do you think you got this huge, huge victory?
My feelings were very mixed on the night, because whilst I was incredibly excited and honoured to have won St Albans, I was also very tired at the time, I have to say. I found out at sort of 3:30 or so in the morning. My party overall didn't have a good night, and the Conservative majority paved the way for us as a country to leave the EU. So I had very, very mixed feelings on that particular evening. But I think, there were lots of different reasons, I think, for the Lib Dems winning here in St Albans. And it's because people vote for different reasons. So some people voted because I think they felt as though I shared their values and they shared mine. Other people wanted to have an MP who lived locally and was a community champion. And I think others, I hope, had appreciated just how hard I was working on a range of different issues, whether that was, the trains and getting extra compensation for local residents who had felt the impact of the disruption, whether it was supporting parents who were trying to get places in schools, or whether it was campaigning alongside our pubs to reform business rates. There were lots of different issues that I was working on before I got elected, working alongside our various community groups. And so I think people vote for different reasons, but for some, as I say, it was for values, others because I was local, and others, I think, because I was working hard. But whatever their reasons were, it's been an absolute honour to serve St Albans in the last year.
Now, you did mention that the Liberal Democrats didn't fare too well in the last election, but you actually did see a 4.2 increase in the share of the vote in 2019, but lost one seat. Why do you think that this upturn in percentage of votes didn't lead to an increase in the number of seats won?
This is a problem that Liberal Democrats face with every single general election as a small party, and it's down to the voting system. It's down to the fact that we have first past the post, whichever person or individual gets the most votes in a particular seat, then they are the ones who get elected. And anybody who's voted for anybody else, their votes don't count effectively. And the simplest way I use to describe this is if you say to people, would you like a tea, a coffee or a beer? If three people say they want tea, and three people want coffee, and four people want a beer, you all end up having to go for a beer, even though 60% of you, six out of the 10, don't want to have a beer, you want to have a tea or a coffee. And so that's how first past the post works. So it does mean that you end up with a lot of wasted votes, and that's why Liberal Democrats and lots of other parties support the idea of having a fairer voting system.
That's a great analogy, but let's bring it on to a community question here. And Rachel wants to know about what were your first months like as a new parliamentarian? Are there any strange rules or procedures that were strange to you that you had to adapt to?
the first few months as an MP really felt like I was driving a car that was out of control, I have to be honest. You know, I often say to people, when I went to the count before I was told that I'd been elected, I had about 6 unread emails across all of my inboxes. And then I came out of the count at sort of about 5:30 in the morning and had about 200 unread emails. On Saturday, I went into Parliament to get my new email address. And by Monday morning, I had more than 3,000 unread emails. Oh, and at this point, I had no staff and I had no team and I had no office and I'd had no training. And yet from day one, there were people saying, I'm going to be homeless in a few days' time. I can't get my visa. I've got this medical complaint and I need you to sign this form within the next 14 days. And there's a huge volume of casework that comes in, people who need your help, and you're desperately trying to sieve through it and find the most emergency cases. I held my first surgery within the first 9 days. We held it the first sort of weekend after the election. And so you're trying to get on top of all of these issues, navigate your way around these different agencies. You haven't met any of the people that work there. And at the same time, you're trying to get to grips with how Parliament works in London at the same time. And so there were lots of very sort of odd procedures and rules. You know, there was the bobbing up and down, but that's been obviously suspended since COVID. And the lack of a list system. So you have to keep bobbing up and down, possibly for hours on end to speak in a debate without knowing whether or not you'll ever get picked. A lot of that has improved during COVID because we've been forced to improve it, and I'm hoping very much that some of the modernisations that have been brought in actually stick, but we'll see.
Was there a specific guide handed to you as a new MP, or did you have to just kind of learn on the job, or even did somebody take you under their wing and kind of go, Daisy, you have to do this, you have to do that?
Sure. So there's a little bit of training in Parliament about how things work. So physically in the chamber, which is where you see MPs sitting on the green benches and debating, there were a couple of sessions where Parliament had got some of the younger members of staff to act out how debates worked, and they had to stand up and say things and disagree with each other. And so they acted out how you're supposed to behave in the chamber, and we all just sort of sat there and watched and tried to absorb how it worked. There were 2 or 3 meetings that I was invited to meet with people who actually are involved in running the chamber. So you actually learn, if you want to get something done, who you should talk to behind the scenes, because a lot of what happens in the chamber is a result of conversations that happen outside of the chamber. I had 2 buddies. So there's a buddy system that's set up. One buddy was a fellow Lib Dem MP, and he's been incredibly helpful to me over the last 12 months. I've been to ask him for help with all sorts of things, whether it's, you know, complicated immigration cases and other such issues. But there's also another person who's a buddy, and so somebody who works for Parliament. And so if we have questions about, well, how do I table an amendment? How do I put in this question? Am I allowed to ask a question in this particular way? If this is what I'm trying to get out of it, how do the things operate behind the scenes? Then there is a buddy who works for the House of Commons, and my buddy actually lives in St Albans, which is really nice.
That is very useful indeed, that they're quite close at hand. Now, Anthony wants to ask about your maiden speech. He says, were you nervous about making it?
It's a funny question, actually. I've been asked this quite a few times. So initially, I wasn't nervous at all about making my maiden speech because I've spoken in public many times before and it's something that I'm quite comfortable doing. But there's this sort of strange phenomenon in Parliament where everybody makes it out as if it's a really big deal. And so as I was approaching my maiden speech, and people kept sort of wishing me good luck in the corridors, and people sort of kept saying, well, when is it planned and have you written it yet? And are you excited? I suddenly felt as though I probably should be getting nervous, even though I hadn't been nervous. So I think because other people were making it a big deal, I suddenly sort of thought, maybe I should be nervous about this. But if I'm really honest, the only thing that really rattled me slightly on the day was that the chamber is incredibly hot. And I hadn't realised that because it was very cold, right? It was in January. And so I had a really thick wool suit on. And I turned out I was absolutely boiling hot and I was incredibly thirsty. And I wasn't sure whether I would get through the whole of my speech without needing to drink water. And that was the one thing that was making me more nervous than anything else. So I wasn't that nervous about doing the speech, but I was nervous about needing to have a glass of water.
Daisy, that is a great look and the story behind the story of your maiden speech there. You know, this is why we talk to you, because you give this great insight into the back doors, basically. But let's go on to the front view, looking at 2020 as a whole. And you know, we don't need to sugarcoat it. 2020 has been uniquely difficult for everyone in politics. And as a new MP yourself, you know, you said that it was being thrown in at the deep end. But are you proud of how you adapted to the problems that COVID-19 posed for you?
I mean, I think to be honest, I'm incredibly proud of how St Albans has responded to the pandemic and how they've had to and how people have had to adapt. I mean, on a personal level, it's been, I think, quite easy for me as an MP because, you know, I have a number of staff. You know, I'd got them all set up anyway to have flexible working. So most of them already were working from laptops, which they could bring into the office or take home. So it was actually very easy for us to adapt to everybody working from home and doing Zoom meetings and all that kind of stuff. So that bit was fine. Obviously, it took a few weeks for Parliament to adapt because it hadn't ever had a virtual Parliament before. And so there was a sort of small hiatus at the beginning of the pandemic where everything was being done by conference calls and these kind of very complicated list systems and people, you know, muting and unmuting themselves on the phone before we could actually get the virtual Parliament up and running. But again, those worked. They were okay and those were fine. So I don't think it was that difficult from a kind of personal point of view. I think what's been really impressive is how particularly businesses in St Albans have managed to innovate. You know, lots of businesses, particularly in the hospitality trade, managed to sort of turn around their service. So rather than eating in-house, they were doing deliveries and takeaways. Obviously, we had a number of retail shops who hadn't ever been online before, who were suddenly having to get a website set up with an online ordering service. Those kind of changes can often take years and years and years. And all of a sudden, all of our local businesses had to do that in the space of a few weeks. And of course, there were many individuals who had to adapt their personal lives because there were, you know, there are thousands of people who fell between the cracks of the government support schemes. And all of a sudden, they went from having a sort of regular income stream to almost no income at all. You know, some sectors, particularly where there are freelancers who maybe work in film and TV, or perhaps they're wig makers, or they work in the events sector, or they run exhibition stalls. A number of those sectors were severely disrupted, and all of those events cancelled. And they had to suddenly adapt to see whether they could do different jobs in the meanwhile. So I think I'm probably one of the lucky ones in that regard. I work from a laptop anyway, so I, you know, wherever I am with my laptop, I can work. But I think seeing how people in St Albans have been incredibly resilient and adapted so quickly, I'm incredibly proud of what everyone's managed to achieve.
Well, that's a positive story for the city, but I want to bring it on to your own personal positives and successes. I mean, just from the top of your head, we're going to talk for civics as well, but what do you feel were your highlights, personal positives of 2020?
Ah, my personal positives. I guess one of the things that I'm most proud about was dealing with the situation that we had with Watford General Hospital, which was at the height of the pandemic. And there had been some repair works that had been scheduled to replace some of the old piping that supports the oxygen system in Watford General. And the repair works had been postponed a few weeks before the pandemic all kicked off. And then we got to a crunch point where, you know, there was a sort of 24-hour period where the pipes stopped working effectively and the oxygen supply was at risk. And I suddenly started getting phone calls from all sorts of different people about this problem. And obviously there was a notice saying that Watford General had closed down the A&E department for 24 hours and asking people not to go there. And it was incredibly worrying. And luckily, actually, I had picked up the phone numbers of a few Conservative MPs because just a few weeks before, there were internal elections in Parliament for select committee chairs. And for some select committees, there are only Conservatives who can become the chair of a select committee. And for other select committees, there are only a Labour person can become the chair of a particular select committee. And so you start to have, so as those MPs are trying to lobby to become, get your vote, they often give you their number and ask you to contact them and all that kind of stuff. So I'd picked up quite a few phone numbers of Conservative MPs who were trying to get my vote for them to become the chair of these committees. And so I messaged a few of them with a bit of an SOS, to be honest, saying, look, you know, these repair works have been postponed by the Department of Health. It's putting people's lives at risk. And can you please tell the Secretary of State that I want a phone call this afternoon? And to be honest, I wasn't really expecting one, but I did get a phone call from the Secretary of State. And with most successful campaigns, there was a bit of public and private lobbying, I sort of said to him, this is the situation. It was your department that suspended these works. We need them fixed, and I want to have an answer, and we need to have the engineers there first thing on Monday. And then we did a little bit of an expose on this issue in the press on the Sunday, just to put on an additional bit of pressure to make sure that they followed through. And then on Monday, the engineers came. And when I got a message from somebody telling me the engineers had turned up, I did just burst out crying. I have to be honest, I was just so relieved to know that there were people from across Hertfordshire in that hospital who desperately needed that oxygen to work. And the fact that I'd managed to help get it right to the top very quickly and get some action, I was incredibly proud and quite emotional about it. I'd say that was my highlight.
That's a great highlight as well, you know, and great to see the emotion that you really care about your constituents and the people of St Albans and Hertfordshire as a whole, because that affected a lot of people. But you also oversaw and extended this care to the community with a successful campaign with support for care homes and care workers. Talk us through this, and also, will you be working more on improving this in 2021?
So this was a really heartbreaking story. An individual person who, a local resident in St Albans, contacted me and asked for a surgery appointment, which we had. And she explained the situation that her family had been through, which was that she had a number of siblings and that her elderly mother was in a care home. And that prior to the pandemic, her and her siblings had been going into the care home and providing huge amounts of care. And I think a lot of people sort of often refer to family carers as visitors because they're visiting a care home, but they're not really visitors. They are performing the duty of caring, but in a care home setting. And they go for hours and they brush people's hair and they touch their hands and they help them with cleaning and washing, and they'll read the newspaper together and maybe watch TV and they'll reminisce about the past and they'll maybe, help them have some food. It's a huge number of hours go into sort of caring for their loved ones. And all under the first lockdown in March and April, nobody had been allowed to go and visit their family, their loved ones in care homes. And we'd started to hear some incredibly harrowing stories as a result. So I'm aware of a case in Hertfordshire. It's not in my constituency, but in a neighbouring one, where because the person in the care home hadn't seen anybody in their family, they just they took their own life. There were other examples from around the country where somebody had nobody in the care home, the paid carers who were run off their feet. I know they do an incredibly good job, but none of the paid carers had noticed that this person had stopped eating and was losing weight. And that person ended up dying as a result of malnutrition because the family wasn't there to see. And of course, we've heard lots of incredibly distressing stories of people at the end of life as well, who maybe have either have a dementia or maybe another medical condition where they may only have weeks to live, and yet they weren't able to see anybody during those final days. And so what we had was a situation where people's health was declining very, very rapidly, sometimes in a really distressing way, because their family carers weren't able to see them. And in these situations, you have a balance of risk. And so what when I heard about this, I heard that there were other situations around the country. They turned out there was a big national campaign. So I decided to try and get involved. So having written an individual letter on behalf of my constituent, I then also asked many other MPs to sign a cross-party letter. And we got about 40 MPs to sign this letter asking for family carers to be given the same status as paid carers, so they could get a test, so they could be tested in the same way for coronavirus, they could get the same PPE, they could get access to their loved ones. We set up the pressure. There was a big debate in Parliament. I wrote some pieces for some national newspapers, piled on the pressure, and the government, after a couple of weeks, did actually make a commitment that this would happen, and that everybody in a care home would have two family members who'd be able to get regular tests. So I think in some parts of the country that has progressed quite well. The testing has been rolled out to people who want to go and visit loved ones in care homes. I'm starting to get reports that that's not happening everywhere, and I think there clearly have been some problems in that system. So I think we'll have to take stock in the new year and see what more needs to be done. But there we are seeing now, obviously, St Albans has and the whole of Hertfordshire is now going to be going into tier 3 at the weekend. We don't know how long that's going to last. We don't know what the situation is going to look like in the new year, but if there is going to be a continuing problem for people to visit their loved ones in care homes, it's absolutely vital that we get that sorted out.
Now, You've mentioned so many times today already, but I do want to delve into it once again, is all this work that MPs like yourself do behind closed doors that a lot of people don't see, that aren't publicised. I wanted to ask, how many constituents have you talked to and helped through in 2020? Is it hard to keep up? And which cases are you most happy that you were able to help and intervene in?
So, do you know what? I've actually got some numbers for you because I thought you might ask this when you said it was an interview. So let me give you some numbers. I have helped 12,000. I've had 12,526 inquiries from constituents related to various different issues. I've sent more than 15,000 emails and letters on behalf of constituents. We've dealt with 199 housing related inquiries, 18 of which related to homelessness, 64 benefit inquiries where we help people get the benefits they deserved, 367 businesses and employment related inquiries that arose during COVID, and 82 immigration related cases related to people who were either trying to get settled status or having visa problems and marriage visas, all this kind of stuff. So and that's all the stuff that I don't normally talk about, because I'll normally talk about big campaigns that I'm working on and those kind of big issues. But there's a huge amount of things, a huge amount of work that we do on behalf of constituents that we don't talk about because it's confidential. But they are things like housing inquiries, making sure that if somebody's got a hole in their wall, that we chase it up to make sure that it's fixed. If somebody's got rats in their home, or perhaps there's water coming down on the inside, maybe there's some mold. We get a lot of those issues sorted for people. I'll be honest, there's probably about 10 individual cases that have been sort of so exceptionally traumatizing that I think about them a lot, and we've had to put in a huge amount of time and effort to help these particular people who have had a very difficult time. And I'm unbelievably proud of my team in terms of what we managed to achieve for those people. And even if I did nothing else for the next 4 years, and I'm going to, but even if I achieved nothing else in the next 4 years, helping out these sort of 9 or 10 individuals who I know that through our interventions and our support, we've really helped them, helped to change their lives basically for the better. And that's some of the most rewarding work we do. But because it's confidential, I don't really talk about it that much.
Yeah, and it's understandable as well. You know, the job of an MP is multifaceted. And I think people usually see it as you're in Parliament, you're debating laws, but you're a support worker, you know, that there's multiple occupations. But just on a personal note as well, and for your team, you said that some of these cases have stuck with you. Do you feel that you're supported, you know, with mental health on these issues to kind of deal with what can sometimes be very upsetting stories for you and your team?
So Parliament is getting better at providing support for this. There are some pretty good mental health services in Parliament, and we're also given sort of training budgets specifically for this purpose, which we're allowed to use if we want to and if we need to. I've encouraged all of my staff to take advantage of it. It can be very distressing taking phone calls from people, and often it's my team who are the ones that will pick up the phone and be at the receiving end when those cases come in. And so we do make sure that we talk through them. I sort of like to check in with my staff to see how they are. We have an understanding, which is that if they've taken a particularly difficult phone call, that if they need to take a little bit of time out, they just need to say, I'm just going off for half an hour, and that's completely fine. So we support each other as a team, but there is professional support available through Parliament, and it's really important that it's there, because people don't tend to, not many people contact their MP as a first port of call. By the time people get to their MP, it's because they've exhausted every other avenue, and therefore it's they're normally at crisis point, and we have to sort of step in quite quickly where we can. I think Parliament is now realizing that this is a big issue, providing the support, and that's a really important thing, and it's important that people know that as well.
Another method of support that you offered for the community, but this was for the nation as a whole, was you used your first PMQs question to press for the case of free school meals. You actually asked the Prime Minister, will he do the right thing? We're now in December. Do you believe that the government has done the right thing?
Well, the government has performed its second U-turn and it has agreed to cough up the money to pay for free school meal provision in the Christmas and the Easter holidays. So that is a positive thing. So it's done sort of the right thing in the short term. But there are still two or three questions outstanding. First of all, there are a number of people, including asylum seekers, for example, who have no recourse to public funds at all. And the children of those families may not be getting free school meals when they should be, quite frankly, in my view. And so I'd love to see the government extend it to that group of people. We have a number of, because of the unemployment crisis that has now happened, there are a number of people who find themselves on universal credit for the first time. And the restrictions on eligibility for free school meals is incredibly tight. So there are a lot of families across the country who are living in poverty who still don't have access to free school meals. And so I think the eligibility criteria needs to be expanded. And I think we need a long-term solution, because this is not a new issue. It's been thrown into the spotlight due to coronavirus, but it's not a new issue. The fact that there are children who are living in families that are disadvantaged so much that they need to have a school meal when school is sitting, it doesn't make sense that you suddenly don't give them that meal when school isn't sitting. They still need to be able to eat, even if it's half term. And so what I hope is that there will be a proper conversation about making sure that there is long-term support there for every single child who needs to get a free school meal.
Could you also tell us about the procedure to get a Prime Minister's question? Because sometimes it is very convoluted. And also adding to that, this is something that has been talked about historically, but do you believe that the chamber setting in these PMQs is still intimidating?
So in terms of the process, in terms of how we bid to get a question, it's a ballot system. So I put my name into the ballot every single week to try and get a Prime Minister's questions. Some people don't bother, some people do, like me, put it in every single week. My name's only been drawn once. And there is an MP who's no longer an MP anymore, actually, but there's somebody I know who was an MP for several years, and they put in every single week and never got pulled in the ballot for a Prime Minister's questions ever. So, it really is kind of luck of the draw stuff. There is a sort of quiet behind the scenes route, which is that if there is something very, very specific that you want to raise because of something in your constituency that's sort of highly pertinent and really important, you can write to the speaker and request that he looks favourably on your request to ask a question because of something that's incredibly timely for that particular week. So whether there's a sort of special anniversary or there's a big event happening or something along those lines, then you can sort of, you can ask for your request to be looked on more favourably, and sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. And that's the same with all questions to ministers as well. So that's the process. Is PMQs intimidating? It's not intimidating for the MPs, I don't think, to ask a question. Obviously, before coronavirus, there would be lots and lots and lots of MPs that would sit in the chamber for Prime Minister's questions. It's incredibly noisy in there. I mean, it can be so noisy sometimes that you actually really can't even hear what people are saying, the ones that are standing up to talk, because of all the rest of the noise that's there. And that's quite tricky. I think for the public watching it, I think my view at least is that I think the public don't like the Yabu culture. They don't like the pantomime of it. I think at the very beginning of the COVID crisis, PMQs seemed to be a lot more professional. And, there were some people where we actually got some real answers to some of the questions. And I think that's what the public want to see.
Let's move on to the Liberal Democrats, the party in 2020. Do you believe that this year has been a successful one for you and the party?
Do you know what? I think there are some really amazing things that my Liberal Democrat colleagues have managed to do this year. And not everybody will know about them, but I'll give you a few examples. So my colleague Munira Wilson, who's our health spokesperson, she managed to do this expose about the fact that there was this terrible kind of drug scandal in care homes where some dementia patients were being heavily sedated, and she managed to expose that and get a front page story and got the government to intervene. My colleague Leila Moran campaigned to set up an NHS bereavement scheme. She was doing a radio phone-in show, actually, and one of her constituents rang up and said that they'd lost a loved one who had been, a nurse, and said, there isn't any kind of bereavement scheme. And so Leyla campaigned for it and the government agreed to it. And that was a great scheme. Our leader, Ed Davey, managed to secure a commitment from the Prime Minister to get an inquiry into coronavirus. Another colleague, Jamie, has set up this group to campaign for the excluded. These are the 3 million people who haven't benefited from the government's support schemes. And it's a really really unfair way in which the government's refused to provide any support. I was leading calls against the 10 p.m. curfew, which was really bad for public health, but also really bad for business. And so I am actually very proud of a number of achievements that we as a party have managed to secure, genuine changes in government policy and changes that will benefit people, not just in our own constituencies, but across the country. So I'm really proud of that. In terms of the party as a whole, I think it's fair to say that at the start of the year, we had a plan as to the kind of things we wanted to do this year. Obviously, those plans were sort of thrown into disarray by COVID. And to be honest, most of us have been firefighting. So there were all sorts of campaigns that we might have wanted to have run and we couldn't because of COVID. I think it would have been incredibly indulgent of us to start thinking about, you know, what's our messaging to the public about what we believe in and all that kind of stuff. When actually you have people at crisis points saying, well, what do these new regulations mean for me and my family and my business? And of course, you know, a number of our staff, not in MPs' offices, but in our headquarters were furloughed as well. So there's been a huge amount of disruption this year. And therefore, I think it's fair to say that we haven't made as much progress as we would have liked to in terms of our sort of rebuilding project. But that's because of COVID. And of course, as MPs, our duty first and foremost is to our constituents. So we've had to focus on that first.
Yeah, let's move on to improvements then, because, you know, we are doing an appraisal. We have to be honest here. And what is something that you think that you will improve on next year personally?
Personally? Oh, goodness me. What do I want to improve on personally? I mean, do you know what? It's a really hard one to answer because a lot of this job, a lot of my job is very responsive. And what I would like to be able to do is I would like to be able to have some time every few weeks to be able to sort of sit down and plan ahead. And that's something that politicians are often accused of not doing. And the reason for that is because we're just so flipping busy trying to deal with all the stuff that's coming in. But I mean, to be honest, I think we'll have to wait and see, because I would love to be able to structure my time in such a way that I could have that time to look forward and do some more forward planning about various campaigns that I'd like to run. But I think we have to be honest that, you know, we're not out of the woods yet with this pandemic. You know, rates are rising again. We don't know what that's going to mean in terms of future periods of lockdown. The vaccine has now started to be rolled out, but there are lots of things we don't know about the vaccine in terms of whether it just protects you from getting the symptoms or whether you can still pass it to other people. There might be that restrictions need to continue for some time. There have obviously been some teething problems, fairly significant ones with the IT systems in terms of the rollout of the vaccine. So my hunch is that probably for the first 6 months of next year, I'll probably continue to be in firefighting mode in order to be able to help people with their everyday problems. And of course, on top of all of that, we have to see what the impact is of whatever comes out of the EU-UK negotiations as well. So I think for the first 6 months of next year, it might be a case of continuing with this sort of dealing with people's issues as they come up, maybe from the summer onwards. If we're in a position to, I'll be able to do a bit more sort of horizon scanning, but I'm not sure we're there just yet.
Let's move this appraisal on to the party as well. What do you think the Liberal Democrats will try to improve on next year or must improve on in 2021?
So there's a couple of things. I guess the first is that necessarily this year we have been firefighting with all these sort of issues that have been thrown up by the pandemic. And I hope that maybe next year, if that continues, we can pick two or three issues that we can really make our own, two or three issues that speak to our values, that tell people, explain to people, you know, what we stand for, and where we can, get significant change in government policy. So I think there's a bit of work for us to do on picking out what those sort of two or three big issues might be that we focus on. And the other issue is that, you know, we know as a party that work for the next general election starts early. There'll be some work that the party as a whole needs to do in terms of working out, you know, which seats it wants to look at and building up campaigning in those areas. So there's sort of, you know, behind the scenes stuff like that.
Now, Michael has moved it on to actual legislation. He's asked, what do you feel has been the most important bit of legislation you've been involved with this year?
So I'd probably say the fire safety bill, on the basis that I've actually been very sort of heavily involved with it. So we have this issue, which as many people will know, we're now sort of 3 and a bit years after the Grenfell tragedy. And there are thousands of people around the country, thousands and thousands of people around the country living in homes that are simply not safe. And leaseholders are being asked to cough up thousands of pounds for building faults that are simply not their fault at all. And we have that situation with a number of blocks in St Albans. We have our fair share here. So I joined the committee that scrutinises the legislation. I have been tabling some amendments and that bill is advancing. So I've tabled another amendment to that bill to try and protect leaseholders from having to pay these outrageous costs. I've been heavily involved in the kind of the casework angle of it as well, because lots of constituents locally who have had been receiving bills and not being able to get various forms filled in. So it's been a really I'm really pleased that for an issue that affects so many people in St Albans, and an issue that is really, you know, it is about having a home that is safe. It's a really kind of core issue as well. It is about safety. And so I'm really proud that I've been able to play a role in the committee in terms of improving the legislation, in terms of being able to take part in the debates, in terms of working with members of other political parties to get, you know, to work on improving amendments, to work across the House of Commons and the House of Lords. We're currently in a stage called ping pong, which you get a piece of legislation and it goes up to the Lords and then comes down to the Commons and it goes back up to the Lords again and comes down to the Commons. And it's a bit like a sort of iterative drafting process where they write something and then they send it to us and then we try and make it better and then we send it back to them and they make it better and it comes back to us again. So we're currently in that stage at the moment. And just last week, I asked the government to consider allowing more time to debate this particular piece of legislation, because the next time that we as MPs get to discuss it, we're probably only going to have an hour. And this is a really, really important issue that affects thousands of people who are living in unsafe homes. So I'm really proud of the fact that I've been involved in this particular bill. It's really important. It affects thousands of people's lives. It affects hundreds of people here in St Albans. And I'm really hopeful that we can improve it before it's passed sometime early in the new year.
As you've mentioned, obviously 2020 has been very hard for the Liberal Democrats or yourself to bring in legislation that you'd want. But if 2021 is more normalised, or maybe let's say 2022, what legislation or law or kind of practices would you like to bring in to Parliament? What's one of the first things that's top priority for you?
Well, I mean, sadly, it doesn't really work like that. It's the government of the day that decides what the legislation is. There's all sorts of things that we can do as opposition parties to table private members' bills and presentation bills. So we can try and table legislation, but it's more just to make a political point that we think an issue is important. Those kind of, as an opposition party and as opposition MPs, the legislation that you try to table doesn't really go very far. And there has to be some kind of real national outcry for it to suddenly get attention from the government. So broadly speaking, it's the government of the day, and that'd be the Conservative Party, that decides what legislation it wants to bring forward, and then they decide how they want to use their government time to debate that legislation. So I guess there's sort of two different questions. One would be, you know, if we were the government, what would we want to bring in? And secondly, you know, what do we think might be brought in? I mean, I guess there's all sorts of different things that I'd want to do. I mean, the first is that next year there's going to be the COP26, which is the UN Climate Change Summit, which we're hosting in Glasgow. I would love to see the government get really serious about the climate emergency and bring in serious legislation with, you know, binding targets every few years. To say how we need to reduce our carbon emissions, how many trees we should be planting every year, how we're going to you know, get clean air, how we're going to improve our energy efficiency. I really would love to see a huge acceleration on that front. I think that is really, really important. And I guess the other really important piece of legislation in the context of Brexit is that so far the government has refused to guarantee that our workers' rights, our environmental standards and food standards will remain the same. And I would love to see legislation that underpinned those, because that is one of the really big things that we're very worried about. And Liberal Democrats worked with other political parties to try and get amendments into the government's legislation to protect the NHS from future trade deals. And that wasn't successful either. So I guess the two big things I would touch on would be the climate emergency and also the legislation that will come out of the Brexit negotiations.
My two concluding questions are forward thinking, future thinking, and hopefully come with, you know, a positive answer. But is there many things that we can look forward to in 2021, Daisy?
Well, I don't have a magic ball, sadly. I wish I did. But I mean, there should always be things that we can look forward to. I think, you know, we know with the pandemic that the vaccine is starting to be rolled out. You know, I want to err on the side of caution. That doesn't mean that the pandemic is over by a long shot. You know, it might be that this pandemic drags on for months, you know, and possibly even through until the autumn next year in some shape or form. But the vaccine does provide some form of relief. Again, we don't know to what extent or to how many people it can be rolled out to, but that is something that we can look forward to, because we hope that by vaccinating some of the most vulnerable people in our society, that at the very least the death rate goes down, we reduce the number of deaths, even if the number of cases does fluctuate throughout the year. And as I say, the other thing I hope we can look forward to is a successful climate change summit, because we are hosting it as a country. The arrival of Joe Biden in the White House, which should signal a big change in terms of America's role and in the world and its outlook and the pressure that it might put on us and other countries. And we know that Joe Biden and his administration will be looking to the UK to show some leadership on the climate agenda. So for now, let's just stick to hopefully the rollout, a successful rollout of a vaccine, and hopefully a successful climate change summit. Those are two things I think we can look forward to. And possibly the weather getting better.
Yes, I'm looking forward to sunny skies again. It's awful wearing all these jumpers and being all kind of locked up. But does the positivity extend to St. Albans? And you've mentioned year two, but what does year two mean for the people of St. Albans?
Well, many of the things that I've been doing this year will continue. So I will continue to run my local surgeries. I will continue to provide support to anybody who needs it on their housing issues, their welfare issues, their immigration issues. I will continue with some of the campaigns that I've been running, whether that's to get fire safe homes, whether it's to protect the River Ver and to get the government to do more on climate. But I think, as I say, it's going to be another kind of wait and see kind of year, because I do feel as though for most of this year we've been responding to events, and I'm looking forward to the first few months of next year. I think we're going to have it's going to be a tricky start to the year, right? We're not quite sure whether we're going to get a deal or a no deal, but we do know that whatever's coming, we're not actually ready for it, and that's pretty conclusive. All reports say that we as a country are not ready for whatever comes out of that. So I'm expecting that the first few months of next year are going to be quite bumpy for businesses as they try to get their head around whatever it is that's whatever the outcome is, those negotiations, as well as dealing with these rising cases of COVID and the rollout of the vaccine. So I think it's going to be a bumpy start to the year, but hopefully let's see where we are come the spring and see if the sunshine arrives and allows us to go out and about a little bit more, and hopefully with that, you know, life might resemble something that's a little bit more normal in a few months' time. But we'll see.
We'll see indeed. And we will see, because we'll be talking to you in 2021. But for today, for now, this is the last time that we'll be talking in 2020. So I have to thank you for all that you've given to Radio Verulam for me throughout 2020, Daisy, for giving your answers to the community questions. And just to end, I'd like to wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy, healthy new year in 2021.
Thank you very much, and to you and to everybody who's listening.